Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in Texas today, meeting privately with families of victims of this month's school shooting in Santa Fe, Texas. He's also fundraising there. And in a remarkable move, he tweeted today that he'd pardon conservative commentator Dinesh D'Souza for making an illegal campaign contribution. And there are reports he's considering doing something similar for jailed former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich and celebrity homemaker Martha Stewart. Joining us now is NPR politics reporter Sarah McCammon. Sarah, let's start with these pardons. Why is he pardoning Dinesh D'Souza? This is a well-known conspiracy theorist. He falsely claimed the Las Vegas shooter was an anti-Trump activist. He suggested that the deadly Charlottesville white supremacist rally was set up to discredit the right.
Right. Well, according to the White House, they just put out a statement that says the president pardoned D'Souza because, quote, in the president's opinion, he was, quote, a victim of selective prosecution for violations of campaign finance laws. So, this is, you know, this is the line we've heard for a while from D'Souza and his supporters. He is a longtime conservative commentator, writer, filmmaker, and he has said for a long time, as have his supporters like Texas Senator Ted Cruz, that this was politically motivated. And we're seeing the president take that line as well. After the pardon was announced, D'Souza tweeted that, quote, Obama and his stooges tried to extinguish my American dream. He thanked the president for, he said, restoring that. So he and his supporters are casting this as a victory for justice. Of course, critics of the president are saying this shows he's willing to hand out pardons to political allies and that it's not what pardons are for.
Well, and maybe people who have been on The Apprentice, Rod Blagojevich, Martha Stewart, both appeared on The Apprentice. Blagojevich was sentenced to 14 years for corruption and is still in jail. Martha Stewart served time for lying to investigators in a securities fraud case. Is there a process here, or could this be a message from Trump to his one-time lawyer, Michael Cohen, whose finances are under investigation, that Cohen should stay on Trump's good side?
Yeah, it's hard to know what the process is. My colleague Aisha Roscoe has done some reporting on the fact that, you know, the president is giving out pardons at a faster rate and earlier in his administration than other recent presidents have. If there's any pattern, it seems to be celebrity. You know, we've seen Kim Kardashian West visit the White House this week to advocate for a pardon for a woman named Alice Marie Johnson, who spent time behind bars. She's not a celebrity, but obviously Kim Kardashian West is. We saw Sylvester Stallone advocating successfully for a pardon for the late boxer Jack Johnson, and the news today, of course. The other pattern is people that appear to be political allies, again, like D'Souza. Then there's Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the controversial sheriff known for his harsh treatment of undocumented immigrants. Scooter Libby, the former chief of staff to Vice President Dick Cheney, who was Libby was convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice. So, yes, it's I don't know what the president's thought process is here, but it certainly seems to that he's at least signaling he's willing to use the pardon. And, you know, people like Cohen must be watching that.
Well, in addition to talking about pardons today, the president, as we said, is in Texas talking about school safety. And there was a remarkable moment in the press briefing yesterday at the White House when a 13-year-old reporter caused Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders to choke up a bit with his question about school shootings.
One thing that affects mine and other students' mental health is to worry about the fact that we or our friends could get shot at school. Specifically, can you tell me what the administration has done and will do to prevent these senseless tragedies?
I think that as a kid and certainly as a parent, there is nothing that could be more terrifying for a kid to go to school and not feel safe. So I'm sorry that you feel that way. This administration takes it seriously, and the School Safety Commission that the president convened is meeting this week, again, an official meeting to discuss the best ways forward and how we...
Sarah, what has the Trump administration accomplished so far after 23 school shootings this year alone where someone was hurt or killed?
Well, first of all, the president has shifted his position a bit over the past several months. He has supported a couple of ideas, things like hardening schools, you know, increased security, letting trained teachers and other school staff carry firearms, an idea that's opposed by most teachers, according to polls. In March, the Justice Department took some steps toward banning bump stocks, those devices that modify guns so they essentially function like an automatic weapon. But, you know, right after Parkland, the president seemed to warm to more gun restrictions and then kind of backed off from that. He spoke at the NRA convention in Texas, and he and Vice President Pence, you know, reaffirmed their support for gun rights.
That's Sarah McCammon, who covers politics for NPR. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, yesterday, President Trump signed what's been called the Right to Try bill into a law that will allow terminally ill patients to more quickly try medications that haven't yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. President Trump says it will save thousands of lives. Detractors say it could be harmful to people and could undermine the whole protective clinical trial system if people opt for untested drugs first. Erin Mershon is senior Washington correspondent with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Erin, another criticism? The FDA already has a compassionate use or expanded access program that allows people to apply to get their drugs more quickly, and that should be enough.
You're right. I think one of the main criticisms of this legislation has been that a very similar process or pathway already exists. So it's important to say in this discussion that what we're talking about is not some new thing that patients couldn't access before. It's sort of a different pathway, and exactly how the patient definition will be defined or exactly which drugs might be used under one pathway or another is still up to sort of the regulators to define. But in general, the Food and Drug Administration did have a pathway in place where patients with terminal or life-threatening conditions could come to them with the help of their physician and ask the FDA to approve a request for an experimental treatment that they were in the process of reviewing. And right now, I mean, the statistics show they're granting those requests in about 99% of cases, often within a very short time frame.
But we understand that some of the criticism is that it's not a short time frame, and that even a short time frame for somebody who's terminally ill is too long. I mean, some felt that the system itself was just too bulky. What does this new law mean? Does it mean that you don't have to go to the FDA anymore? You can just ask your doctor?
It's a little more complicated than that. So the new law essentially lets you work with your doctor to go straight to a drug company and ask for permission to use the drug. The drug company is not under any obligation to give you the drug, and if they decide to, they can charge you, so you might have to work with your insurance company on how to pay for that drug. And the drug company will still have to report that it's sort of engaged in that sharing process with you to the FDA at the end of the year. It just sort of takes out the FDA step in the middle, which supporters say is important for some patients. I think it's important to say, though, I want to say there are about three dozen state laws in effect that do very similar things. And it's not really clear yet that any of those have been used. So exactly how many patients this will help, exactly how many people there are out there who would need to access this pathway in a different way, separate from what was already in place at the FDA, is really unclear right now.
So you've just said that the drug companies that might work directly with a doctor and patient do have to report to the FDA. Do these drugs have to reach any kind of bar of testing from the FDA?
Absolutely, yeah. The drug companies aren't allowed to share a drug unless it's in an active clinical trial and it has to have passed through phase one. Supporters say that that's sort of a basic safety threshold that the drug will have had to meet. But opponents are saying that even drugs that have sort of met those basic safety thresholds might not be as safe as some people think they are, certainly haven't been proven effective yet. They're worried about snake oil salesmen, I guess is the best way to put it, who might try to take advantage of desperate, vulnerable patients who are at a very tough and trying time in their lives and who might be willing to try anything at all, might be willing to pay anything at all. And this is taking the FDA's role in overseeing patient safety and efficacy out of that equation.
Well, and then the supporters of this say these people, you know, are dying and they should be able to have their last wishes when it comes to their medicine. So that's been the tug of war there. But there's also concern that this might undermine the entire system because clinical trials and the infrastructure of medication right now depends on people becoming involved. And if people are not involved because they're taking these other pathways, they might undermine it.
I think that's right. I think there's a concern that any time that you start to move away from the FDA's role in overseeing the safety and efficacy of the medicines that Americans are taking, that American companies are developing, people raise issues. I think that's absolutely a concern that opponents have with this legislation.
Yeah. Well, yesterday, President Trump asked FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb to start this, you know, in 15 minutes. Don't wait. But he, of course, was one of those who joined many Republicans concerned about rushing this bill through. When might it start?
That's a great question. I think a lot of that is up to the FDA at this point. So they have to sort of set out the regulations or the guidance to define exactly which patients will be eligible for this pathway, exactly which products will be eligible for this pathway. Commissioner Gottlieb said, told the president yesterday that he's ready to start as quickly as he possibly can. But I know right now, you know, we saw some an internal email from the FDA that showed that they're, at least for now, directing questions to drug companies and while they still work on that guidance and that regulation.
That's Erin Mershon, senior Washington correspondent at STAT. Erin, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Robin.
All right, more to come in the hour. Although Jeremy and I both want to disclose, it could be rocky because we were up way too late last night watching the finale of The Americans.
This is the great show about Russian spies posing as Americans during the Cold War. The finale, Robin, is being hailed, and you won't be surprised. I wasn't surprised by this, as one of the best series finales of all time.
They had some music in it.
They did. I mean, no spoilers here if you haven't seen it yet, but they did use a song by U2, With or Without You. They said they tried out other songs, but this one was just magic.
This is, of course, the theme, which I'll miss so much. I'm going to start watching season one over again.
I'm tired because I watched the finale. I'm sad because the show is over.
I couldn't believe when they, oops, out of time. Millions tuned in to watch the wedding of Prince Harry and American actress Meghan Markle, now the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. And now, back to reality for the 2.2 million people getting married this and every year. Wedding planner Summer McLean, also a contributor to the Huffington Post, is here. Summer, we're teetering on June. Talk about weddings in the works, ones you've worked on, the royal wedding, African American and British. You've planned cultural combinations.
Well, I did a Habesha wedding, an Ethiopian wedding, about 4 years ago, and the entire wedding was just full of, I mean, down to the food, it was nothing but cultural. Like, I was a fish out of water there, you know? But it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever witnessed. Down to the flowers, down to the music, the food, the cake, ceremony, everything.
Was Ethiopian?
Yes.
Yeah. Talk about cost. The average cost nationwide is $26,029. This is according to the Wedding Report. This is a research company in Tucson. And couples struggle to stay on budget because there's so many wedding TV shows. TLC's A Wedding Story, Whose Wedding Is It Anyway, Bridezilla's, Say Yes to the Dress. People don't realize that the TV producers are pouring money into those weddings.
That average wouldn't cut it in Atlanta at all. The average 26,000. That's like, wow, I don't even know. I don't have clients who even would come to me with that budget at this point. But in Atlanta, the average is about 46, 47. It depends on what they want. You know, half of my job is managing expectations. And yeah, people watch these shows and they see magazines and they see the royal wedding. You know, people forget that stuff costs money.
Well, what are some of the things, for instance? I'm thinking flowers. I mean, those flowers alone were millions. Where are some of the places where people say, I want this, and you have to tell them how much it costs?
Flowers would be the number one thing. I have clients all the time who are just shocked by the price of flowers. And also cake. You can get a wedding cake for $2,200, you know, and you could get the same cake for, you know, a 16th birthday party for probably $8,000.
Yeah. You pay for it. Who pays for it? Is it still the bride's family?
Most of my couples pay for the wedding themselves. Yeah, that's super traditional. I've only had about 3 clients whose fathers paid, you know, like the bride's family paid.
What about wedding parties? You know, as we noted that the Duchess did not have bridesmaids. Yeah, that can cost too. Are people cutting that out?
Okay, it's funny because when I saw her do that, I was like, yes, you know, because I think that that's a trend that a lot of people are going to start following. I've only had a handful of brides who have done that, and they're older brides.
Why do you say yes? Why would that be?
Because it's messy, and it's, I mean, for a planner, it's, you know, it's just drama, and you know, for the bride, it's drama too. There's a lot of competition that happens. You know, it's like, you know, yeah. Oh, is she going to stand closer, you know, closer to you than I am? You know, I'm your friend from middle school, or, you know, I've known you for the past 10 years. There's just unnecessary drama, you know?
Mm-hmm. And cost. A bridesmaid.
And cost.
Yeah, a bridesmaid's dress or cost is $1,200 to
$1,800.
Yeah. So, you know, the cost that they incur. And what about wedding planners? In a 2017 survey by brides.com, 31% of engaged couples sought the help of a wedding planner. That's up from 10 years ago. What would you tell someone other than, you know, hire me? What would you tell someone, if they're looking for a wedding planner? What's a tip?
I think it's not just looking at their Instagram. You know, it's about talking to their previous clients and not just looking at reviews online. You know, I think talking to the previous clients and asking them, you know, what their experience was. I'm actually shocked that it's not more people. I feel like planners are always screaming, actually all vendors, you know, like hire a planner, because at your wedding, it's too late to realize that you need the help.
You know, you talked about magazines. Mm-hmm. And I just want to note an article that you wrote for HuffPost about why there aren't weddings of color reflected in magazines.
Recently, a website, Style Me Pretty, was going out of business. I guess they sold to another company, and then the company just didn't realize how much of a staple it was in the industry. And all these wedding vendors were losing their minds over it. And, you know, a lot of the vendors of color, you know, we were like, I don't really care. You know, like you don't show our weddings anyway.
Why is
and,
that?
I mean, just to be completely candid, I don't know if a lot of people find, you know, couples of color beautiful, which is the truth. You know, you look at a bunch of these other blogs and they think putting maybe an Asian bride with a white groom is diversity. I have submitted many weddings of my couples who are black. They just get passed over. But it's something we don't talk about enough in the industry. So when you do start talking about it, then you're the one who kind of stands out and everyone's looking at you like, oh, God, maybe if you just did better wedding, you know, and it's like, you know,
well,
you just don't
find, feel, well,
you know.
Well, you feel the same way about when there's lists of wedding planners. Best wedding planners in the South is one in a magazine and not one of color in the South. I find that incredible. Yeah. I think there's nothing prettier than a darker skin with a white wedding dress.
Thank you. I agree. Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, you know, I've had to call out. I'm not shy at all. To be honest, when Trayvon Martin was killed, that's when I had to stop being just a wedding planner. And I was human. And so I couldn't really hide how I felt about these things anymore. Not that I really hid them before, but I was a lot more vocal. So, you know, when you have the best of come out, I'm always out there saying, you don't have one black vendor on here. Mm-hmm. You know, you couldn't find one black florist, one black planner, one black photographer. You know, like it's that they don't even look. And we're out there.
That's Summer McLean, wedding planner and Huffington Post contributor. Summer, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I have to say, I'm still reacting to $46,000 for an average wedding in Atlanta. People, let us know where you saved money on a wedding. My niece Dia's fiance's family is growing their flowers. Your ideas at hearnow.org. And now to Shelbyville, Tennessee, population 21,000. In the 1950s, Tennessee's governor declared Shelbyville Pencil City to recognize the importance of the manufacture of wooden pencils. There were a half dozen companies. Well, the nickname has stuck, but for the most part, the industry has not. Today, the last business standing is Musgrave Pencil Company. As it turns out, they've found a way to adapt. Steve Harouche from member station WPLN has that story.
The Musgrave factory on Shelbyville's West Lane Street smells like some combination of sawdust, graphite, wood glue, and paint. There are wood slats getting fitted with leads, freshly cut pencils tumbling out of shaping machines, and painted pencils piled high in hoppers and storage bins. This company started in 1916 when James Rayford Musgrave began cutting wood slats from the Tennessee red cedar that was abundant in Shelbyville at the time. He shipped those slats to Europe, where they were made into pencils. Why not just make the pencils himself? Well, he had that same thought. So he traveled to Europe and bartered some of his slats for pencil-making machines. By 1923, Musgrave was the first manufacturer of pencils in the South.
It signaled the beginning of the term Pencil City. Big expansion at that time, okay? Another big company coming in.
That's Al Simmons, a Shelbyville native and president of the Bedford County Historical Society. Simmons says that for decades, the pencil industry was a reliable source of jobs.
A few years back, you still see a few notices in the paper today where people worked at Empire or Musgrave and retired after 45 years of experience. You know, it was a good place to work, good steady income, and they were loyal to each other.
But by the 1990s, cheaper imported pencils had entered the market, and manufacturing had begun to move overseas. One by one, the pencil factories were sold off or shut down. Musgrave saw its share of hard times, including layoffs and across-the-board salary cuts. But the company survived, until eventually it was the only one left. Part of surviving meant rethinking their entire business, including the raw materials.
We are in the wood department of Musgrave Pencil Company in Shelbyville, Tennessee.
Henry Hewlin is the founder's grandson and was Musgrave's president for 25 years. The wood in question is no longer Tennessee red cedar. Decades ago, the cost got too high, thanks in part to demand from furniture makers. So Musgrave started sourcing their wood from a company in California. But in order to cut costs, that company moved their factories to Tianjin, China. Most of what they process for Musgrave is basswood, which grows in Asia, but not all.
Some of it originates in California and Washington State, and some in China.
So there's wood that gets harvested in the U.S., gets sent to China to be cut into slats.
And sent back to us. Wow.
I think the average person would think that's a little weird.
Yes, they would.
Thanks to competitive shipping rates, this arrangement is cost-effective. But even with adjustments to their supply chain, Musgrave still can't compete with imported pencils on price. Up in his office on the second floor, Hewlin explains just how much cheaper Chinese-made pencils are.
Probably about 50%.
Really?
Yeah, a lot.
But to achieve that low price, Chinese companies have to make a lot of pencils.
If your company want a custom pencil and you want 100 gross, you're not going to be able to get 100 gross from China.
Because your order is too small. But Musgrave has been able to find a sweet spot in the market, filling these kinds of smaller orders and supplying retailers who want a made-in-the-USA product. Its clients include school systems, Home Depot and Lowe's, even the White House gift shop. Musgrave is now one of only four pencil manufacturers left in the United States, and the only one in Pencil City. But Hewlin remains optimistic.
Slowly and slowly, we're back to where we're fairly busy now. Knock on wood.
For Here and Now, I'm Steve Harouche.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Did you just make that up?
Well, yeah.
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
...18 hours and 45 minutes. That's soon to be the length of the longest commercial flight in the world. Singapore Airlines announced the flight this week from Newark to Singapore. The route will start this fall using a new lighter Airbus plane. Joining us now is Seth Kaplan from Airline Weekly. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So Singapore Airlines actually discontinued this flight in 2013. It was the longest flight in the world, but it wasn't profitable. Why are they restarting it?
Yeah, aircraft technology, Jeremy. I think a lot of people think of new technology as being able to, you know, fly farther or faster, but sometimes it just comes down to economics. And yeah, you could fly this long. You could fly longer if you wanted to a long time ago. But as an airline, you couldn't make money doing it. I was actually on that flight once. I did Newark-Singapore back in 2007. And I remember having goosebumps and getting a bit teary-eyed as I landed, realizing that that was as long as you could be on a commercial plane right. flying halfway around the world, 18 hours plus. Yeah.
When you say airline technology, are you talking about just lighter planes? It's easier to go a longer distance?
Yeah, lighter planes and more powerful engines. This plane, a special version of the Airbus 350, a rather new plane, only needs two engines. When I flew that back in 2007, that Airbus 340 at the time needed four engines. So you think about doing it with half as many engines, and you imagine how much less fuel you're burning. That can tip the balance in an industry where, sometimes the difference between profits and losses is rather small.
Who is this flight meant to appeal to?
Well, it's meant to appeal to business travelers, especially who value time. You know, once you add a connection in, it's always going to take you at least another 2 or 3 hours to get somewhere. So there are people who are willing to pay something extra for that nonstop flight. And that's what the airline is counting on. Won't even be any economy seats on this flight. It's all going to be business class and then premium economy. And that's mostly because of weight. Part of how you make this work is, not only do you need all that new technology, but you still need to kind of lighten the load. And so not very many seats, a fairly large airplane, but just about 160 seats on board.
How many meals do you have over the course of 18 hours and 45 minutes?
Yeah, it's three primary meals. You know, they'll serve you dinner and then sort of a mid-flight meal, a sandwich kind of thing, and then a breakfast when you land. But they're pretty generous, too, about giving you something extra along the way if you need it.
There was a story earlier this year about a Norwegian Airlines flight that made it from New York to London in record time, 5 hours and 13 minutes.
Yeah.
And part of that was because it had a very fast jet stream. Are jet streams changing, and is that helping airlines get to places faster than they used to?
Well, yeah, a really strong jet stream, no question. It also takes, honestly, some other luck to fly that quickly. That record-setting flight happened to fly at an unusual time. It was a daytime flight, you know, rather than kind of leaving in the evening, getting to London in the morning, like so many other flights, which causes that congestion. This one left New York late morning, got to London at night, and so they were able to sort of sneak in. Everything went smoothly. The jet stream, yes, but then some other more prosaic factors that helped them get it as quickly as they did.
I have to say, by the way, for anyone who flies to London, a daytime flight is the best thing ever, because you get in, you have dinner, and you go to bed, and then you're on their time. It works much better than the overnight flight. Seth Kaplan from Airline Weekly, thank you so much as always.
Jeremy, always a pleasure.
The Russian journalist who worked with Ukrainian authorities to fake his own death said today he was smeared with swine blood and taken to the morgue as part of the elaborate sting operation. The Ukrainians say the staging thwarted a real Russian plot to truly kill Arkady Babchenko, a fierce critic of President Putin, and gave them time to arrest a Ukrainian who allegedly paid $40,000 to arrange the hit. But the Russians are scoffing at that. They're also seizing on the faked assassination as fake news, even though it's true that enemies of President Putin do tend to die. Let's bring in journalist Edward Lucas, longtime Russia watcher from London. Edward, welcome.
Hello, Robbie.
And what was your reaction over the arc of the story of Babchenko, this notion that he'd been assassinated because of his writings about President Putin? He'd fled Russia to seek asylum in Ukraine, and then that he showed up at a press conference very much alive.
First of all, I was horrified and very angry that yet another journalist had been killed, yet another Kremlin critical journalist had been killed, not the first in Ukraine, not the first in Russia. Then when it turned out that he was alive, I was obviously, first of all, delighted. I was still angry that the Russians had been trying to kill him, that they'd sent this hit squad, it appears, to Ukraine to kill him and other people. And then I was very puzzled because I was wondering why the Ukrainian authorities went to such extraordinary lengths to run this sting operation. And I was then worried that perhaps the minuses in the long run would prove greater than the pluses, that this would be a tactically brilliant success, but actually maybe a strategic misstep in the long run.
Well, and talk just a little bit about that, because already global journalist organizations are decrying, you know, using a journalist to, yes, it might have been a staged death to throw Russia off the trail so that the Ukrainian officials could bring in this suspect. But it was a journalist involved in faking something. It casts doubt on the credibility of journalists.
Well, Robin, I think there's a difference in perception here that we in the kind of old West put rightly enormous store by journalistic integrity, people should tell the truth and so on. In Ukraine, it feels very different. They feel that they're at war. They feel that the West is largely abandoning them. The Western media doesn't write about the dozens of Ukrainians who get killed on the front line and all the other things that Ukraine does. So appeals to sort of Western journalistic principle don't cut perhaps as much ice as they should. And they feel that this was a tremendous success of the first time Ukraine was able to fight back against one of these Russian assassination operations. So why aren't we praising them? But there are other questions to ask too. Was it really necessary to conduct such an elaborate sting? Another question is, why haven't you shown similar zeal in investigating the deaths of all the other journalists who've been killed in Ukraine, which is, you know, sadly 4 or 5 in recent years? Is this perhaps a bit of grandstanding by the General Prosecutor's Office and the Ukrainian Intelligence Service? Is this something to do with the run-up to the new Ukrainian presidential election? Maybe to So all these questions, with the sort of thing we usually ask in Russia, are being asked in Ukraine. And I think that's a worry, that in the attempt to resist the sort of Putinist offensive, maybe some countries come close to Putinizing themselves, and that's certainly a concern.
Well, and Russia is seizing on this as fake news, and so you can see that play out as any time, you know, somebody may be truly assassinated in the future, Russia may plant the seed of doubt that it didn't really happen.
And Russia's already doing that with linking the attempted murder of Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia, the Russian spy who spied for British intelligence, was living in the West, and his daughter, who were poisoned with a nerve agent in Salisbury and could have died but didn't. And the Russians have been very energetically trying to stoke conspiracy theories about this. And now they're saying, well, maybe the Brits did it to Skripal just the way the Ukrainians did it to Babchenko. And that's a very bad road to go down, because the big difference between our system and the Russian system is that we do believe that there's a kind of common narrative about what happened yesterday. That's the basic narrative strength of a democracy. We can argue about what to do next, but we have a sort of rough consensus about what happened, that facts are facts, and that people, broadly speaking, tell the truth. And once you move away from that to the idea that everything is just different versions, I think it's quite bad for democracy and also quite bad for Ukraine's reputation in the West.
Well, remind us some of the other recent deaths in Ukraine of either, journalists or critics. We know there were some car bombings recently. What are some of the names?
Well, this Pavel Sheremet is perhaps the most conspicuous example, another Russian opposition journalist. Then there was a businessman who was a very strong Putin critic who was killed. And then there was an emigre Chechen, a Chechen woman who was married to another emigre leader, very critical of the pro-Kremlin regime that runs Chechnya now, and very supportive of Ukraine and its military struggle against Russian aggression. So there's quite a pattern of this, with everything from car bombings to shootings to poisonings. And of course, not only in Ukraine, we see critics of the Kremlin meeting untimely ends in all sorts of other countries too. And this is, from the Kremlin's point of view, these people are basically terrorists and they are better off dead. From our point of view, we would rather not have the Kremlin dispatching summary justice and extrajudicial execution in our towns and cities.
Well, to remind people, I mean, there's a name that was floating around for a while and a lot of people were scratching their heads and saying, who was that? Sergei Magnitsky, who died in 2009. He was a lawyer who was investigating a tax fraud case with an American, William Browder. He died, Magnitsky died in police custody. There were sanctions against Russia in his name. They bear his name. And in fact, when the Russians came to meet with Trump family members in the tower, they were talking not about, as was said, adoptions, but they were talking about getting rid of these Magnitsky sanctions. Tell us more about him.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Robin, because Sergei Magnitsky was a real hero. He exposed a massive tax fraud, not against his employer, who's a Western investor, but against the Russian state. This was Russian officials stealing from the Russian state by claiming a tax refund and then pocketing it. And he was thrown into jail and treated very badly and told, we'll only let you out if you will testify against your employer and switch sides. And he said, I'm not going to give false testimony. And he was beaten to death after about a year in prison. It's a very tragic case. But his employer, Bill Browder, has spent the subsequent years running a global crusade, I think you could call it, for justice for Magnitsky and to punish both the officials responsible for his ill treatment, but also the people who benefited from the fraud. And that's pioneered these Magnitsky sanctions, which you mentioned, which are not the sort of sectoral sanctions where you say Russia can't sell this stuff or Russia can't buy this stuff or Russia can't raise money here or there. These are very targeted sanctions against individuals. And I think they're one of the greatest weapons we've got against the Putin regime and going after the top 1,000 people and maybe some of their associates is a really powerful weapon. I'm delighted that the Congress in the United States pushed for this very hard, even though the Obama administration didn't want it, and that went through. And lots of other countries now, too many to count, are implementing these sanctions as well against Russian and other human rights abusers.
Well, and so there is some legacy to some of these, as you say, heroic victims, but not enough. I mean, why do you think there isn't more hue and cry about, I mean, the name, the list of names, Anna Politkovskaya, Alexander Litvinenko, poisoned, Boris Berezovsky. Why isn't there more of an outcry?
The truth is really quite uncomfortable to contemplate, which is that Russia is acting as a rogue state which conducts extrajudicial executions in other countries. That's a pretty uncomfortable thing for our politicians and decision makers to wake up to. You mentioned Litvinenko. That was 2006. We've had pretty much a rerun of that with Sergei Skripal. And now, finally, we're taking it a bit more seriously, but not enough. And there's a big lobby on the other side. You know, all those people in Delaware who make shell companies in Nevada and Wyoming and British Virgin Islands, the City of London, Cyprus. There's a great lobby out there of people who make their money from lobbying the proceeds of crime, and they are very keen that this system should continue.
That's Edward Lucas, longtime Russia watcher, a friend of Here and Now. We really appreciate you weighing in, and we should mention your latest book, Cyberphobia, Identity, Trust, Security, and the Internet. Edward, thanks as always.
Thank you very much, Robin. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
Today, President Trump is in Texas meeting with the families of the victims of the Santa Fe High School shooting. That was the 22nd school shooting of the year in this country where someone was hurt or killed. So it caught our attention this week that a video game called Active Shooter was pulled before its release. The game was pitched as a school shooting simulation set to be released on Steam. That's a gaming platform. But after outrage from many, including families of the victims of the Parkland, Florida shooting, its release was canceled. Ben Johnson covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So describe this game for us. Is it as bad as it sounds?
Well, this is not a game made by a large company like Electronic Arts or Blizzard. That's important to note. It was reportedly made by a lone developer, this person named Ata Berdiev, and published by a small company. It's an independent game, any of which can be put online with the help of Steam, which acts as a kind of marketplace or distribution platform connecting players with the publishers and developers. By the looks of the screenshots, Jeremy, and previews online, yes, this game was sort of what it sounds like. You could play a SWAT team member or someone from law enforcement, or you could play a murderer with an AK-47, which would make it a simulation of killing civilians and in some cases kids with automatic weapons.
And there was a lot of backlash, rightfully so, obviously enough for it to be pulled before it was released.
Yeah, so gun control advocates and families from victims of the Parkland shooting got wind of this game before it came out. It was set to be released on June 6th and cost $5 or $10 on Steam. Opponents of the game got a petition started. It got 18,000 signatures. Interestingly, Jeremy, Steam took the game down supposedly because it said that the developer was really a troll with a history of abusing customers and breaking Steam's rules about things like online reviews. Noticeably missing from this, of course, is the reason that most people wanted the game taken down. There's been some suggestion that the publisher of the game meant it as a kind of sarcastic commentary, you know, of the state of affairs in the U.S. when it comes to gun control, for instance. So it may be that Active Shooter was actually kind of designed to get this kind of reaction.
There has long been fear that violent video games in general, even ones not as close to reality as this one, might encourage violence. What did the study say about that?
Yeah, so this has been a really sticky topic for decades, but video games have now been commonplace enough for long enough that there has been some hard research science on this, and the evidence really just isn't there. You know, in fact, there's been evidence that people who commit violent crimes actually consume less media than the vast majority of people who don't. Academic institutions have done research on this. The Federal Trade Commission has looked at this. The Secret Service actually did a study on this in 2004. And there was an economic study in 2016 that actually found that violence does go down across the country after big video game releases, which is kind of interesting. There is evidence that video games can create kind of temporary sort of spikes in aggressive behavior among kids, but it appears to be temporary. And most of the science around this really says that there is no causation there.
I'm not a gamer, and I know that there are a lot of violent games out there and games that simulate crime, Grand Theft Auto being one of them.
Sure.
But a game about a school shooting, given what we're seeing right now in this country, does make me think that the industry really doesn't understand limits.
Yeah. I mean, I think clearly this is a moment in time that is an inflection point for this conversation, right? And I think that this game being pulled is an example of that. You know, these fears really go back to the Columbine shooting in 1999. And after that massacre, there was a real sort of reckoning, I think, in the country around violent media and what kind of contributions it made to that shooting because those kids were gamers, right? But at the end of the day, video games are really categorized as art, right, and entertainment, and thus are, at least in the U.S., protected by a freedom of expression. Of course, we're going to see in video games things that are abhorrent, things that we believe are in poor taste. That's normal because it's a vast spectrum of art.
But that's the difference, though, is you're saying it's art, but it's art that is going to be consumed by people who are younger than maybe somebody who's going to go to an art museum and see some controversial piece.
Sure, impressionable. And I, you know, there are age restrictions for games and age recommendations for games. And this is the thing that happens, you know, in order to try to prevent impressionable people sort of consuming content that's not appropriate for them. As far as the industry, you know, I think it's tough because this person who made this game was a single kind of alone.
Not one of the big players.
Yeah, not one of the big players, and also like a lone developer, if you will. Someone who might have been creating this game just to get this kind of backlash, may be actually trolling. So I think that's an interesting aspect to this as well. I think one of the interesting things that has come out of this conversation is the idea that there's a copycat aspect to this game, for instance, where you're learning how to do something like this. And I think it's worth having that conversation. What's interesting is that the evidence doesn't seem to lead to actual correlation there.
It's Ben Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.